I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
This is Radio Times. I'm Alan Tu, sitting in for Marty Moss-Cohen. Today on Radio Times, a more personal look at the life of Nikki Stern, who was a leading advocate for 9/11 families. Nikki Stern lost her husband, Jim Pertorti, in the North Tower after it was hit by one of the hijacked planes on September 11th. Pertorti was a vice president at Marsh McLennan on the 94th floor. Nikki Stern went on to serve as executive director of Families of 9/11 of September 11th, and she also served as the 9/11 Families Liaison to the New Jersey Governor's Office. She is now a writer and a communications consultant in Princeton, New Jersey, and she is now sharing some of her more personal struggles through her writing. In this past year, her essays have been published in the New York Times, USA Today, and Newsweek, and in those, she shares everything from how she struggled with the emotions of having a new relationship with a man who also lost a family member, to her frustrations with the news media and how they use 9/11 family members in coverage as sort of moral authorities on 9/11. She joins us this morning in the studio to share with us her experiences over the past 5 years. And Nikki Stern, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Nikki Stern, I was hoping we could start with you doing a reading from your most recent essay in which you talk about sort of the ambivalence surrounding this last 9/11 anniversary. This is the one that was published in USA Today just a few days before this year's 9/11 anniversary.
Okay. As we approach the fifth anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, there seems to be a collective national ambivalence about how we should commemorate that September day. Certainly for family members like me. My husband, Jim Pertorti, died in the World Trade Center's North Tower. Marking the date has proved to be even more conflicting. I still live in the New York metropolitan area, so there are a number of events and memorials available to me. I could attend a ceremony at Ground Zero where the names of the victims will be read aloud and a bell will ring at the times the planes crashed into the towers, and again, when the towers fell. Or I could attend a small service in my local community. I've received invitations to a reception at the governor's mansion, a candlelight vigil held by my late husband's employer, and an exhibition of photos earmarked for a memorial that has yet to be built. The fact is, we don't know what the five-year mark is supposed to mean. What exactly are we supposed to remember? What are we to do? In many parts of the country, 9/11 is just another day. It's the beginning of school. It's time to head back to work after a Labor Day vacation. Even in the Northeast, where the shockwaves of the attacks were more intense and longer-lasting, everyday routines take precedence. I'm okay with that.
That's Nikki Stern. Nikki Stern, how did you end up spending September 11th this year?
I really didn't plan, but I ended up getting up in the morning and walking my dog, Molly. Then I went over to a friend's house. She had had a more structured day. They went to church. They went to the cemetery. I don't have any of those things available to me. So basically, the dog and I played in the backyard until my friend and her family came home. We had lunch together. Then I went back home. I did a little writing and played with the dog and thought about what I thought about and went to bed. And I woke up at 12:01 and I said, it's not September 11th.
On September 11th, did you have the television on at all?
I didn't. My friend did, and I actually saw a little bit of the ceremony with the spouses reading the names and talking too, which I was surprised about, but I did see some of that.
For you, is it hard to escape the reminders of 9/11 with these big movies that are coming out about 9/11 and all of these news documentary specials? I mean, is it everywhere for you, everywhere you look?
It's everywhere. It's everywhere for everyone. You know, there's a lot of discussion about whether that's too much or too little or what's supposed to happen. Certainly on that day, you know, it's the fifth anniversary. There's something about 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then I guess we'll do 10, 20. So certainly on that day, there were the movies, there were three or four TV programs, I think, a number of books came out, and then there was so much coverage. It was very hard to escape.
Did you, I know you know a lot of other family members who lost someone in 9/11. Did you discuss with any of them, your friends, about, you know, some of the confusion that you had about what to do on 9/11? Did others share this kind of ambivalence?
Absolutely. I think that what we might hear about or what we might be aware of are the people that spoke. And
yes.
Those are the people that knew what they wanted to do. But there were a lot more people, at least that I knew, that just weren't, they just didn't know what to do on that day. It just feels so public.
Do you feel like, for those who didn't lose somebody in the 9/11 attacks, that they're looking for that same kind of, like, how am I supposed to feel? What's searching for that same meaning in a similar way?
I think so. I mean, it's... I don't know anyone anymore who survived Pearl Harbor, and I wish mm-hmm. I did, because I would like to ask them what they did. I do remember people trying to figure out what to do on November 22nd. You know, Kennedy was shot, and some of us were very little, but then trying to figure out for years afterwards what to do. But I think that we're so close to this event, and it reverberated. And I think people are just... trying to understand what it is they need to do. And what I'm telling people, mm-hmm. because I had a lot of friends from around the country ask me, what should we do? What should we do? And I said, do something for someone else. Do something good. I mean, it could be very simple. And then think about the fact that you're doing it to pay your respects. Maybe that's the best thing to do.
You know, for a lot of Americans, 9/11 itself, I think, has become, you know, somewhat of a political or cultural event that kind of marks the beginning of the War on Terror or the Patriot Act. For you, you know, what does 9/11 mean now? I mean, has it changed over time?
Well, it's for me, it's much more personal, but there's a very good reason for that, and that is that I didn't go from being a person that was unaware to a person that was suddenly aware. I mean, I've always followed issues. I've always followed political events. I've always followed cultural events. But what I find fascinating is that this was a turning point for some people. One of the things I noticed right away is the increase in coverage in the newspapers about international news. Some of us who were interested in what was going on in the world before 9/11 were hard-pressed to find anything in terms of coverage. Everything, it was as if we existed without the rest of the world. And now a lot of people know, they may have the wrong information, but they have a rudimentary knowledge of the Middle East and Africa and things like that.
We are talking this morning with Nikki Stern, who lost her husband in the World Trade Center attacks 5 years ago. Nikki, I was hoping you could share with us a little bit more about, you know, your life prior to 9/11. Your husband, Jim, he worked as a vice president of Marsh McLennan. What kind of work did he do?
It wasn't extremely exciting work. He was a business analyst, pretty much back office kind of a thing, not the masters of the universe sales kind of position, really analyzing computer programs that saved the company money.
How long did he work in the World Trade Center?
They had moved, I'm not sure of the exact dates, but they had moved in the late 90s from Midtown to the World Trade Center.
He worked on the 94th floor. Did you get a chance to visit his office a lot?
I didn't. And, you know, it's sort of ironic. I used to tease him. After 93, it was difficult, not impossible, but hard to get up the elevators in the World Trade Center to the private offices.
I mean, this is after that first
bombing attack.
In the parking lot.
So I said to him, and he was being shuffled around a bit, and he moved floors just before 9/11, but I said, why can't I see your office? I mean, sometimes I wonder where you really work.
Yeah,
you're working
right.
for the CIA,
right.
And I don't know that.
But you never did go into the
I always went to
world?
The World Trade Center, always. I would take the train in with him, uh-huh. and then I would take my a different subway up to my place. And I went shopping there, and uh-huh. We went to Windows on the World. I just never saw the
offices.
Oh,
you did go to Windows on the World.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, did you ever, the World Trade Centers were such tall buildings, and I think this is a lot of people share this idea, but, I mean, did you have worries about him working in such a tall building? I mean, you know, the usual things were like what if there's a fire or something like that?
I I quizzed him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he came home with the floor plans when they were going to move him down. And I said, all right, here's the thing. I mean, there was a bombing. So I want to know, you know, this. I want to know that. I want to know that. And he said, oh, we've got this protection. We've got this protection. I said, what about planes? You know, how do you get out? Blah, blah, blah. And I remember asking him. And I remember him telling me that they were also doing some drills in mm-hmm. terms of using the staircases and all of that.
Wait, did you say you asked him about planes?
I asked him about, yeah, sure. I mean, I wasn't thinking a terrorist attack. I was thinking a small plane could crash into a tall building like that.
And oh no, I understand. What was your? What I mean, how would you describe your life together? How long you guys were married, and were you guys living in Princeton?
Yeah, we were living in Princeton. We had originally lived in a one room apartment in New York, and then a one room apartment in Long Island. You know, so we knew each other pretty well. We were married. 11 years, almost 12, and known him for 13. I had been married 11 years, known him for 13, and it was incredibly comfortable. It's very comfortable. We didn't have any children, so what happened is what happens with married couples without children. We just were very close to each other. We did everything together. And I would, not everything, but many things together. And we just were comfortable with each other.
Now
we had a lot of fun.
What kind of job did you have? I know you were working in New York City and that you commuted with him in the morning.
Yeah, I was the director of public relations for a big architecture firm in New York City. And I did some of the work from home. And then 3-4 times a week I went into the office.
On September 11th, 2001, I'm kind of curious. I'm guessing that you were at work in New York City. So how did you learn about
I actually wasn't.
You weren't?
No. I had gone in the day before, and I was so frustrated by a move we'd made. They'd moved me from a large space to a really tiny cubicle, and that's very irritating. So I said, I have to get a better attitude here, so I think I'll work from home. So I was actually picking up some coffee and some groceries, and somebody, a clerk, ran down the aisle of the supermarket yelling, "A plane crashed into the World Trade Center." And it's so dramatic to say time stopped. It's so dramatic to imagine everything slow down and go into slow motion. But it did. It absolutely, everything they say about that and that they portray in the movies is true. Everything just stopped. So that's,
Did you think it was a large plane? Or did you think, like that scenario that you were talking about earlier, maybe a small plane accidentally hits the building?
I didn't, but I have to say that I knew fairly quickly. I mean, I had to get home and turn on the TV, but I knew fairly quickly that the plane had gone in where my husband worked. So for me, and there are many different stories, none of which I want to get into, but obviously my particular situation was a certainty that unless he wasn't at his desk, and I don't know that actually now that I think about it, I really don't know where he was, but unless he wasn't at his desk, that he was going to be directly affected.
And you never got a call from him that morning?
No, which leads me to believe he was at his desk.
This is Radio Times. Our guest is Nikki Stern. She lost her husband in the World Trade Center attacks 5 years ago. She went on to become an executive director of the Families of September 11th. She was also the liaison for the New Jersey Governor's Office to the 9/11 families. And she currently works as a communication consultant and writer in Princeton. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us.
Support for WHYY provided by the Philadelphia Museum of Art, now presenting Treasures, the Arts in Latin America. This diverse pan-national show uncovers largely unknown works of art, including paintings, ceramics, textiles, and gold and silver treasures from Brazil, Peru, Mexico, and 10 other Latin American countries created in the centuries following Columbus, Cortez, and Pizarro. For information, fellowmuseum.org. The museum supports WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. With primary season over, states brace for possible glitches in their brand new electronic voting machines. Also, music critic and vinyl junkie Christopher Black resisted as long as he could. Now he's gone iPod. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Do you have a teenager who suffers from attention deficit disorder, or ADHD? Are you looking for a non-medication treatment? The University of Pennsylvania is conducting a research study with an investigational magnetic device to see if it helps treat young people 14 to 21 years old who have an ADHD diagnosis. To learn more, 215-573-2684. 215-573-2684. The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Alan Tu, in for Marty Moscowane. We are hearing from Nikki Stern, who lost her husband in the World Trade Center attacks 5 years ago. Stern went on to serve as the executive director of the Families of September 11th. She is now a communications consultant and writer in Princeton, New Jersey. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can at 1-888-477-9499. Nikki, you know, everything about 9/11, I think, was confusing for everybody, but for the victims' families, what was the process? I mean, how were the families contacted? Was anybody coordinating this? When was the first time anybody called you?
There was a lot of confusion at the beginning, especially for people that lived outside New York City. And it's difficult to remember that there were a lot of families who were affected who lived outside the immediate city limits. There was an enormous outpouring of aid and inflow of money right into the city. And an amazing effort. But for people that lived in other places, it was a little hard to get information. And in New Jersey, we had, well, and also in New York. In New York, there had been an election, so there was a transitional government. But in New Jersey, there was a temporary governor because our previous governor had gone up to be the director of the Environmental Protection Agency.
Right.
And so we had a temporary governor. Richard
Cote was in
– No, it was Donnie DeFrancesco. Don DeFrancesco.
The series where there are a lot of governors.
Yeah, a lot of governors.
That's right. What were some of the needs of the families? I mean, what were some of the – tasks that needed to be done?
There were a couple of things. For some of the families were not sure where the next paycheck was coming from. Now, I was someone that worked, and my husband, although he was not didn't make $1 million or anything like that, he worked for a very large company, and it was an insurance company, and they actually moved more quickly than almost any other company in figuring out how to at least create a 2 or 3 month safety net for people. So that, combined with the fact that my employer had insured me I could stay on, gave me a safety net. I didn't have children, so there were I had to take care of myself, of course, and I was devastated, but I didn't have I was very nervous financially, but not to the extent that people that were perhaps living in new homes that with huge mortgages and 3 or 4 kids. On the other end of the spectrum, and you don't hear about these people, there were enormous number of people, particularly at my husband's company, who, because he was in computers, who were from out of the country. So they, and this was also true with Windows on the World, there were people who maybe had green cards, but maybe their families didn't. Maybe English wasn't their first language. And there were people missing. There were very few people recovered initially. So out of almost 3,000 people, there were 300 bodies that were found. And everybody else had to go to the medical examiner's office. And it was very, very confusing. So there was a confusion with aid. There was a confusion with information. There was a confusion with the medical examiner's office.
How long was it for some of the family members before they were, I don't know, issued a death certificate? Did that happen?
The process
quickly?
Began fairly quickly, but initially the process was at Pier 94 in New York. I went the first day, and it was both efficient and inefficient. And I got a death certificate on the 20 May, before the 1st of October, but it was wrong. because the people that they had enlisted were so nervous dealing with these crazy, grief-stricken people that they got the information wrong, and maybe the people gave the information wrong to them. So almost everyone I know had to refile, you know, to get a corrected death certificate. And then another thing we didn't know is that you required, they gave you 10, but you really needed 20, because every single thing you did, from canceling a credit card.
For instance, you needed 20 death certificates?
Yeah, I would need a death certificate to cancel my husband's frequent flyer program. I would need a death certificate to get the mortgage in my name instead of our name. It was an incredible process.
Now, maybe this happened later, but I'm curious, what was at least the process of trying to return, you know, personal items to those killed in the World Trade Center to the families?
There was a process that took 3 or 4 years, which, if you think about it, it's understandable, yeah. But also unbelievable in terms of pain and pressure. There were something like 90,000 items, which represented only a fraction of the items that might have been collected, and those were collected. And those all had to be cataloged. They had to be looked at for contamination. They had to be sorted. There were a lot of things that were hard to identify. And then information had to be gotten. There was jewelry. More of the jewelry was melted or it was half melted. I mean, it was a very long, long process.
Was anything delivered to you?
No, and I wouldn't have wanted anything.
Fair enough. This is Radio Times. Our guest is Nikki Stern. She lost her husband in the World Trade Center attacks 5 years ago. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a question for her, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. When did you decide to get involved in becoming an advocate for 9/11 families, and why?
Well, the why was in two parts. The when was a couple of weeks after, probably by October 1st. And the why was equally divided, I think, between my need to survive and have a reason to get up. It's funny, when you don't have kids, you are spared perhaps the panic of having to worry about how they're doing. But especially with how I was feeling at the time, I really could have just stayed in bed forever or worse. And I didn't. There was a part of me that didn't want to go to the worst place. So I said, I got to do something. And work isn't quite it. Although they were letting me stay on at work. And so because I worked in New York, because I knew New York, and because there were so many people in New Jersey that weren't agencies and organizations set up quickly in New Jersey to help people get information or money. Some of the United Way agencies weren't getting the money from the big United Way that had the money in New York. So there was a lot of work to do and a lot of advocating to do. And so that there were two reasons. One is there was a clear need, and the other was that it was going to help give me focus.
Now, I don't know if you became executive director right away, but as executive director of Families of September 11th, what was your job? How big in scope were you thinking?
I always thought along a couple of lines. First, there were actually as many as 10,000 family members. You know, if there are 3,000 victims, right. And if somebody has a brother and a sister or a mother and a father or kids, there are many, many more victims. And my interests were in the long-term effects of this kind of a tragedy, specifically on the families, but also from a more long, excuse me, from a more long-standing aspect, how we respond in terms of emergency preparedness, and also how we respond in terms of mental health needs. And those were two issues that I became very interested in.
And where did your organization, where did it get the funding? Was it something that came from the various nearby states, or was this federally funded, or just donations?
Neither. This was privately funded, and it was quite amazing. There was a lot of money that came into the big charities, particularly, not exclusively, but particularly Red Cross, and then also the United Way umbrella. And some of that money was used to designate certain of the organizations that formed to support their outreach efforts. And as time went on, while I, during my tenure, we also got some monies that were given to us so that we could work with psychologists and psychiatrists in terms of trying to develop materials that might help children of trauma and build resiliency. I also served on the emergency preparedness organization that was just getting things together when Katrina hit. You know, there were a lot of long-range consequences. There were other people that were working on prevention and response to terrorist attacks. So this was a kind of a springboard for larger issues that some of us wanted to
For your address. Group, families of September 11th, I mean, who did you guys bump heads with the most? I mean, you're probably coming up against a lot of bureaucracies.
I didn't really by the time I became executive director, I think the worst part was for me was at the beginning when I was working representing New Jersey. I mean, we really didn't get any respect, and it's not a joke. It's right, absolutely right. True. And, I mean, I literally had to walk around and saying, 710 families, 710 families, hello. So by the time I got to families of September 11, the members in the board, there hadn't been an executive director before, but they had a really solid reputation. I think they, especially this organization, was really pretty known in Washington, D.C. for pushing both for clarification on existing legislation that was passed so quickly after 9/11 and then also the development of other legislation that would address the terrorism issue.
I'm kind of curious because I did read this one article. You came across a lot of family members who, because there was money that was given, aid money that was given to the family members, and there were, you know, the concerts, the charities, and that there was this perception that, you know, a lot of money was going to some of the family members, that that this one woman I was reading about, I mean, she talked about how some long-lost friend began to call her, you know, and it was like, it seemed like they were reconnecting, and then she started asking about the money. I mean, do you think because there was this perception that some of the families were getting money, that also there were people who didn't have really good intentions that kind of glommed onto that?
I mean, I suppose some of that happened. I think the whole money thing was hugely exaggerated, blown out of proportion, misunderstood. Brothers and sisters didn't get money. Children, widows got money, but if they had children, for instance, in the state of New Jersey, there were a lot of rules having to do with how much money you had to put into trust for your children. So I think that the media, as is typical, certainly glommed onto the dramatic stories of the one or two people that went out and bought multi-million-dollar homes. But that really, that was scarcely the norm and scarcely the case for most most family members.
Now, when did you decide to turn to writing as a way to kind of either work out some of issues and to share with us a lot of personal things about your life?
I started writing the day after September 11, and I think it was a consequence of having nothing in the house, including a goldfish. I mean, it was so... You know, when you live with someone and you're very close to that person and there isn't anyone else, if that person goes away, then half your life goes away. Or that's exactly how it seemed to me. I sat for months in front of a laptop computer with a glass of wine and a carrot stick, if you can imagine this image. A carrot stick stuck in a peanut butter jar and a glass of red wine. That was what I ate. I mean, I dropped 15 pounds in the first month. And just typing away and saying, you know, among the conspiracy theorists on AOL or the this or that, saying, hello, is there anyone, you know, I lost, can I talk to anyone? And finally I just said, well, you know, I'm going to just say what I'm going through. And I wrote about everything I was going through. And it was all mixed up. It was personal. It was professional. I had a whole chapter on my meeting the now infamous Governor McGreevy and going to work for him. And boy, I just should pull that chapter out and look at it again.
Well, one of the things that you did share, this was the one that I saw in the New York Times. It was a very personal issue. It's about this relationship you had with a man who also lost a family member. Did he lose a son or a daughter?
He lost a family member.
He lost a family member. Fair enough. The relationship, I understand, began maybe sometime in 2002 and lasted like 3.5 mm-hmm. years. Why share so much? And what kind of feedback are you getting on this essay?
I think I was struck by two things. I was struck, one, by the way in which, again, I'm beating up on the media, and I'm part of it, and I don't mean to, but the way in which the media was making some kind of strange animal out of 9/11 families. They were either greedy, horrible widows, or they were saints, or they were noble people that were riding to change the political landscape of the United States, or they were meddling busybodies. But there was just there were so many stereotypes, and from a personal standpoint, everything you heard about at the anniversaries was either somebody that said, I've decided to be a nun, and that's the rest of my life, I met somebody, and I'm getting remarried, and I will always remember so-and-so, but I'm so happy. And I thought, boy, that is not real life. That's not, 9/11 widows, by the way, are like other divorced women and all sorts of women. It's messy. Life is messy. And I was trying to humanize this image of a 9/11 family member as being outside the mainstream of messy human life.
And did you get a lot of feedback on that?
Mostly positive. I obviously got the one or two, and I knew that. And I already thought that about myself, so they didn't tell me anything I didn't know. But I got a lot of feedback saying thank you for humanizing a situation that's gotten blown, way out of proportion.
In that essay, you mentioned that, you talked to some friends and you shared with them that you had this relationship, and a lot of your friends, at least from what I can gather, they were telling you, "Whoa, too soon." But I guess the question is, how does anybody know when soon is?
I don't know. I don't know. How I don't know how you do it. I look back now, and it's 5 years. I don't know how you connect with people. And maybe it's because I'm living with my dog now and saying, uh-huh. "Oh my God, this is all too scary." But it just happened,
Now, in our conversation here, one of the phrases that I have tried to avoid, and it's because of my own uncomfortableness of it, is the term 9/11 widow. How does that phrase hit you?
I hate it. A 9/11 widow is a widow who lost someone on 9/11, as opposed to one of the chapters of this never-to-be-published memoir, mm-hmm. diary, is called Garden Variety Widow. Because I tracked myself over the course of a couple of days, and I was doing things that I would guess that normal, and I say that with quotation marks, widows do, thinking about things that normal widows do. So, if I put the papers down and I turned off the TV and I didn't take the phone calls asking me how I felt about the latest Osama sighting or the bill that was pending before Congress, I was a garden variety widow, maybe a little young, but still, I was somebody that lost somebody and had to figure out how to live without this person, but still remembering this person.
What kinds of calls would you get from news media? As a 9/11 widow, what kind of calls do they think that you could answer?
Oh, everything. I always thought it was funny because I do have a graduate degree. I did study these things. I did work for an architecture firm, but... what is your vision of Ground Zero? What would you like to see there? Not even just the memorial, the whole thing. And I have an undergraduate degree that I had a minor in urban planning, and I said, I don't know. There are experts.
All right, we're talking with Nikki Stern. She lost her husband in the World Trade Center attacks 5 years ago. She went on to become executive director of the Families of September 11th. She currently works as a communication consultant and a writer in Princeton. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. After this break, we'll go to calls. Thanks.
Dressage at Devon supports WHYY. Dressage has been called poetry in motion, harmony in movement. World-class horses and riders compete in this ancient equestrian art at the 32nd Dressage at Devon Horse Show.
September 26th through October 1st at the Devon Horse Show Grounds in Devon, Pennsylvania, with festival shops, kids corral, and Ladies' Day hat contest. Benefits Thorncroft Therapeutic Horseback Riding. Information at 484-358-5510 or dressage@devon.org.
Next time on Day to Day.
Loading only.
Airline passengers with all that baggage are finding a new way to bypass long check-in lines.
They're letting someone else haul their luggage to the airport.
No long lines, there's automatic check-in. Your bags are handled for you, which is always a problem.
A new airline delivery service takes off.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Delaware Art Museum is proud to support WHYY. Portrait photographer Jack Mitchell captures the action, passion, glamour, and beauty of the brightest stars of the visual and performing arts. Icons and Idols, a photographer's chronicle of the arts, on view through October 1st at the Delaware Art Museum. Full details about the Jack Mitchell exhibit at the Delaware Art Museum available online at delart.org. The Delaware Art Museum is proud to support WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Alan Tu, in for Marty Moscowane. Our guest today is Nikki Stern. She lost her husband in the World Trade Center attacks 5 years ago. She went on to become executive director of the Families of September 11th. She was also the liaison for the New Jersey Governor's Office to the 9/11 families, and she currently works as a communications consultant and a writer in Princeton. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Let's talk to Dave. He's calling us from Flint, Michigan. Dave, you're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I mean, absolutely no disrespect at all to 9/11 families, and I mean this question very, very seriously. I lost my father tragically in an automobile accident as we were growing up, and you know, after a brief period of mourning, my mother went back to work, and we all went back to school, and our life resumed, and you know, as best we could, and we made adjustments, and life went on. And again, I mean absolutely no disrespect. I'm trying to understand what I mean. I understand, you know, we had planes flying into buildings, and everybody, you know, very, very tragic. But how 9/11 families are having such a hard time moving forward, and not to discount their loss. Compared to, you know, all the other Americans who lose people in automobile accidents and plane crashes, or, you know, folks who are involved in the Iraqi conflict. And so I guess that's my question. I'm really having a hard time understanding the differentiation between the sudden losses that other people have compared to the 9/11 families.
Dave, thank you so much. Go ahead, Nick.
Hi, Dave. First of all, I actually agree with you that, I mean, I agree with where you're going in that. I think that I don't think it's so much that the 9/11 families are having more of a problem. I think that in the immediate aftermath, there were organizations formed because this was such a large national public, which continues to be the issue, that it was such a public process. It's very difficult to grieve when somebody keeps throwing – it would be like seeing the scene of the accident on television every day. I mean, that's – it's almost impossible to describe what that's like. But I think the other issue is that the 9/11 families you hear about are the ones that are having trouble processing, and most of the large numbers of families are processing. The number of families that are needing help is shrinking every year, and it's not really any different in the end of the day, except that it keeps recurring in the media and keeps it stays a public event, and you have to put it in the context of the public tragedy.
Nikki, you know, another essay that you wrote. This was the one that was published in Newsweek, and this was titled "Our Grief Doesn't Make Us Experts." What inspired you to write this? And I know that, as we were talking earlier, that this might contribute into a future book. But why write this?
I was a little stunned by, and this maybe goes back to Dave's thing too, I was a little stunned by all the attention. I understand that there was some kind of national transformation that took place wherein somehow if you were a relative of someone who died, you became some kind of a symbol for something bigger than yourselves. But we used to get asked all sorts of questions about our expertise or not our expertise, right, but our feelings about, our opinions about whether we should have gone into Afghanistan, whether we should have gone into Iraq, whether Osama should be captured, killed, this and that, the other thing, Saddam Hussein, who, you know, in my view and from what I've read, regardless of what you think of him, didn't seem to have anything to do with 9/11. So we were getting called and asked all sorts of things, and I found this stunning, and I found it stunning that there were a lot of families who, family members who were certainly willing to offer opinions on those subjects.
But again, I guess what you're saying is a lot of 9/11 family members are kind of goaded into this process, like, you know, tell us what you think, tell us what you think. And so a lot of this is pushed on them.
Well, you can't underestimate the seduction of a microphone and a camera mm-hmm. when you are grief-stricken, because one of the things that happens, and I'm sure you know everybody knows this, is you seem to lose your voice. And then suddenly somebody is saying, you know what, I can't get rid of this pain, but I can really occupy you by giving you this huge platform, you know, having you rushed into makeup, hair, and asking your opinion. And that's really going to take away from your concentrating on your grief because, you know, I'm giving you this big platform. It's very seductive.
You know, I was kind of curious if you and other 9/11 family members, or if you guys talk about this kind of thing, but this personal struggle of how much do you want 9/11 to define your life? I mean, maybe you don't have a choice, or maybe you do.
Oh, we talk about it all the time. I mean, my closest friends are none of them was ever in the limelight. Those are my closest friends. And there are a couple. I mean, I don't have mass numbers of new friends that I made as a result of 9/11. My core group is still people that are unrelated to 9/11. But the two or three women who are exactly in my position who have become good friends, we talk about that. And we know that because it's in the history books and because it's going to be talked about to a certain extent, it will define us. But we also know that we are, at the end of the day, people that lost someone and that there need to be lives. I'm a widow. I don't know any way around that except to get married again, but I don't want to be a 9/11 widow.
Right. I know. I understand. All right. Let's talk to Bruce. He's calling us from Pemberton, New Jersey. Bruce, you're on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I attended bar at Windows of the World in the late 70s when it first opened, and my reaction to the plans for the Freedom Tower is that it really seems kind of mawkish and self-serving. I mean, I don't understand what a height of 1,776 feet has got to do with 9/11. And as someone that worked there and would have died that day if I'd been there, my inclination is the way to put a thumb in the eye of Osama bin Laden is to build the towers exactly the way they were and have people working in them and make them more secure, make them better engineered. But, you know, if your guest wants to chime in on that,
right,
I'd like to hear it.
Thanks very much,
thanks
Bruce.
A lot.
I know you did a lot of work on the 9/11 Memorial in Lower Manhattan, as well as the New Jersey Memorial. But, yeah, did you get involved or did you have a role in terms of the design for the Freedom Tower or anything?
Well, I mean, only as an observer, because before 9/11, I worked in marketing and public relations for a large architecture firm. And I was part of the architecture community before 9/11 in that respect. And the thing is that people had a lot of different reactions to what should happen at Ground Zero. I mean, this gentleman has a feeling that the way to say to the terrorists, so there is to get everything the way it was. There are family members that felt nothing should be built on it because for them it's a graveyard. People in the architecture community honestly thought, well, you know, let's look at this as an opportunity because mm-hmm. the Twin Towers weren't that beautiful before and let's build something else. But then the Freedom Tower is like everything else. It sort of falls prey to the political conveniences of the time. 1776 is a symbol for our freedom. Mm-hmm. Does it have to do with 9/11? Only if you're really stretching it and getting this. I mean, freedom. Why would you call an office tower the Freedom Tower? It's symbolism that political forces chose. It was pretty much out of our control. And I don't know. I guess you live with it, and you either get tenants or you don't.
In terms of the actual World Trade Center Memorial, Was that also a really tough process because everybody had many, many different ideas and were very passionate about it?
It was really a tough process. And again, it's funny because I look at this as a member, or at least tangentially, of the architecture community. And the way that it was done is the way that winners for competitions are done. It happens all the time. This was exactly the process that normally would accompany this kind of a commission. And you have a jury, you pick a very qualified people, you have a couple of representatives, and there's been pretty much a lot of objection. I think a lot of people have problems with the underground aspect of it, and now they're bringing some of it up. I think the thing that's amazed me the most is how much alteration there has been, so that it still may be absolutely gorgeous, but it's certainly going to be a memorial by committee.
Now, it's called, if I'm correct, Reflecting Absence. It's scheduled to open September 11th, 2009. Mm-hmm. Since I really don't have a picture of what it looks like, can you help us understand what it looks like in relation to the office buildings that will be there?
I'm going to try, okay. But you have to understand that it is changing so rapidly. Okay. What it is, the concept is that the footprints, which became very important to some family members, mm-hmm. as representing the towers, I'm not one of them, but I've always recognized that it was important to other people that this represented. So the center concept of the memorial is that the two footprints are preserved, and they're preserved as voids open with water coming down. Now, whether or not you can actually go or will go downstairs, it seems to be less clear now because of money considerations, et cetera. So it may be that you just stand along the side and look down. And then there'll be a park light area, and the buildings that they're talking about will ring the park like area, and they'll be in descending height. So the tallest one will be the Freedom Tower, and the next one, I think, which is the one by Norman Foster, will be slightly shorter, and then Richard Rogers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there'll be kind of a semicircle ring around the open park-like area.
Now, I don't know if this is part of a memorial or something separate, but I read somewhere where if you go down, or they will allow you to go down, where I guess there's parts of the World Trade Center that I guess they left untouched with some of the twisted metal and maybe a buried fire truck. Am I correct on that?
Those are artifacts. Okay. And they're actually those artifacts reside, some of them out in John F. Kennedy at JFK Airport, and some of them are with the State Museum of New York, and they will be brought back and exhibited so that you'll be able to see representative artifacts in the adjacent museum. The museum that will be adjacent to the memorial.
I know that you are also involved in the New Jersey Memorial. That'll be called Empty Sky. Where are we at in terms of its construction? And can you help us understand where it's going to be located and what the feeling that it's supposed to give?
Well, like everything else, yeah. It got caught up in controversy, and I think it was based on a misunderstanding. They were digging in order to start building, and they piled up some dirt, and people thought that was going to be the height. And really what is going to happen, what the plan was, that yes, it would be right at the water's edge, but other than these two columns, thin columns of names, it's really about landscaping, and some of the landscaping would involve a higher elevation. But it was scheduled to be right at the front of Liberty State Park, adjacent to the station, but I'm hoping it stays there because that's the concept, but mm-hmm. I don't know.
Do you know when it's scheduled to open?
Again, it should be a year after it starts going up, but we're held up. I'm hoping that it opens in 2007.
Since 9/11, the U.S. launched its war on terror, which includes the two wars. This has really polarized the American public. Where do you come in terms? Do you choose just to stay out of sort of the politics of post 9/11?
This is where my whole concept about moral authority mm-hmm. comes in. I have a lot of opinions, but my opinions are not based on the fact that I lost someone on 9/11. And that may make me different from some family members, by the way. But I've certainly heard people say I didn't know anything before, I didn't pay attention before, I didn't care. That's not true of me. You know, the only thing I know, because I did have a personal loss, is I hate to see my personal loss used as a political football.
Right. Now, Ann Coulter, now you are not part of the Jersey Girls that were part of the 9/11 Family Steering Committee, but she kind of accused them of using their widowhood status to publicize their concerns, which were to get more follow-up on the 9/11 Commission recommendations. How did that debate affect you when you heard Ann Coulter attack those women?
Well, I mean, I know Ann Coulter's trying to sell books, and right. I know her last book actually didn't sell very well, so she probably had to do whatever she could, including be, you know, ridiculously provocative by saying they probably weren't sorry their husbands died, which is maybe one of the most insane or inane comments I've ever heard. But the fact of the matter is, again, the Jersey Girls had a platform, and their concerns had to do with very directly with their loss. And so, yes, they used it to advance their concerns, and their concerns were about safety and security.
Now, when the 9/11 Commission did its investigation, it finally came out with its report, I think, in July 2004. Was that something that was of great interest to you or not? I know you weren't involved in the group that tried to get the commission going, but did it still have a lot of meaning for you?
I was involved more than I let on, because uh-huh. I do a lot of stuff behind the scenes. Okay. And, of course, it was important to me, because I think it represents what is best about where we live, which is the exercise of freedom and democracy. I think that we provided in the United States an environment in which an investigation could take place, that wouldn't be true in another country, and recommendations, solid recommendations for the most part, could be made to improve safety and security for the betterment of everybody that lives here. There's no downside to that as far as I can tell.
And are you happy with the progress in terms of what follow-up there has been on any of the recommendations?
I think of the 41, some have been followed through very well. Others, I know there are a couple of areas having to do with port security and security of nuclear facilities that we're falling a little behind, I think, in terms of really making sure we're safe.
Now, I know you've done a lot of writing this year and that you are putting some work towards a book. When might we see your book and what is it going to be about?
I got two books going, which is probably a terrible idea, but one of them's for fun. The book on moral authority, hopefully in 2007. The book, the novel, who knows?
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks so much. Nikki Stern, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today, and best of luck with your writing.
Thank you.
Nikki Stern lost her husband, Jim Pertorti, in the World Trade Center attack 5 years ago. She served as executive director of the September 11th Families and is now a communication consultant and writer in Princeton, New Jersey. I'm Alan Tu, sitting in today for Marty Moscowane. You're listening to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, your member-supported NPR station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.